You are listening to another Screenfish One-on-One, this time live with actor Kelvin Harrison Jr. and writer-director Trey Edward Schultz. In the new film Waves, the audience is drawn into the world of a suburban African-American family as they process grief, love, and loss in the midst of a terrible family tragedy. In a special roundtable discussion with star Harrison Jr. and Schultz, we get to talk about the blurred lines between love and hate, the challenges of the film's unique cinematic style, and finding hope in the midst of tragedy. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish.
Okay, I think you have some of the best beat drops outside of a Scorsese movie. I love the way you applied music.
Thank you.
But people are very critical about, you know, they feel like music bullies people into feeling a certain way. Can you say why your use of music was essential to this story?
Well, thank you very much. It's funny you mentioned Scorsese too, because I think, you know, he makes the best soundtrack films out of anyone, I think. And like that would, like for me, I love a lot of soundtrack films. I love Goodfellas, I love Boogie Nights, I love American Graffiti and Dazed and Confused, and I think that got back to the, that was always in the DNA of this, you know, because I think music is another, it's another part of the world of a film, you know, so sure, it can be a shortcut to things if you have a pre-existing experience with it, but for me, it's just another, it's another part of the filmmaking, you know what I mean, having a soundtrack that hopefully feels honest to these characters in their world. It's a part of the storytelling, and for this movie, like, yeah, I consider it a soundtrack film where that's very much the ebb and flow, and in the purpose of getting you closer to Tyler and Emily's world and headspace. You know?
Following up on that, were there a piece of music that you really wanted to get but couldn't get the rights for?
Shockingly, no. We got so blessed. We were insane and embedded like so much of this music in the script, and you could press play and pause as you were reading it, just to set the tone from the beginning, like, we're gonna have to go for it. But we were all like, well, this is insane, we're never gonna get, you know, we're not gonna get Kanye and Frank and Radiohead and everything in between. And I don't know, man, we just got very, 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 very blessed.
Also, adding on to that, did most of the soundtrack come from like your personal taste, or was some research involved?
Pretty much my so I kind of used it as the excuse, like, especially since this is a high school film. Like, for me at that age in high school, music was huge. It was way bigger than films, and it got me through a lot of things, you know. And I was really music hungry. It wasn't just what was like the hits and on the radio. It was everything. Whether that was re-listening to older things I loved or discovering new things I love. So I thought we could take sort of creative liberties with the film of like, if I'm playing by the rules I had in high school, then I think Tyler and Emily could have that in high school and like be the same way with music. It was a lot of music. I mean, it's all my favorite music. And that also made it, I think that helped us in getting the rights to it, because I could write letters to all these artists and talk about what the movie's about, what it means to me, but why their song means so much to me, why I think their song works so well with the film, hopefully, and yeah.
I'm trying to, very interested in that, yeah. Leonard O'Connor. But Calvin, actually, this one's for you. I want to know, because I've heard a lot in regards to interviews that you guys worked very closely on just the ideas behind the film. Right? Therapy sessions, as they were talked, as they were noted as. But I wanted to ask you, is this the first time you've been this involved in the pre-production of a film, and what was that like for you, man?
Kind of. I had an opportunity right before this movie. I did a movie called Gully, and that director let me, like, get really in there, surprisingly. So, yeah. And so I think I had a bit of a tease of what this could be like, but never in this capacity. Because we started talking about it long before, but it wasn't until I got the script. Like, me and him, we met at a coffee shop, and he told me about the two parts of the movie and which one I wanted to choose, and then he would tailor the role for me. And so, but the conversations we were having were just general conversations about life. And then by the time I got the script, that was when I was like, oh, whoa, you actually care about my thoughts on character and dialogue and what would be said and what wouldn't be said. So that, I mean, it's incredible to collaborate in that way, and it really helps you as an actor dive in more, and so that the performance doesn't feel like a performance to me, where I can actually just feel like I lived in it. I don't have to try so hard to hit marks, hit beats, or try to execute anything. I can kind of just breathe, and it just made the movie experience so much easier and more fun, honestly, because I don't like doing the whole, I don't know, I'm not a theater actor, so I get insecure when I have to like really act, you know.
Kind of adding on to that note, I'm so interested with A24, the fact that all of the films that they decide to produce and distribute are all consistently so great. And this was neither of yours first films with them. So what was that like? Did you get like more creative freedom because of that?
Yes. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's great. That's what, it's the similar kind of thing of like, you know, why I love working with Cal and want to keep working with him and work with the same crew of like, if you can build a creative family, it's the best thing in the world. So like going back to A24 and already having those relationships established and everything, it's huge, you know. You know, but it comes with freedom. There's also pressures. It's still, there's money involved. There's a lot of talking. You have, it's still, it's not complete every freedom, but like they're amazing. At the end of the day, we made exactly the movie we wanted to make and had their support. So feel very, very blessed to be in this situation.
How important was it for you guys to have this kind of story have both arcs to it? Because historically in film, we get to build up the crisis and then credits, or conversely, you'd be like, this happened, here's the grief and the trauma and the rebuilding after that. How important was it for you to sort of have sort of the yin and the yang, sort of have them both sort of balance each other out?
For me, it was everything. And so exciting to me, because I do, like you said, the yin and the yang, like I feel like the movie is kind of about dichotomies, you know, and dichotomies in our lives and the good and the bad of a human being, of your family, of relationships, your loved ones, the highs and lows of love, everything in between. So like literally structuring the narrative in a dichotomy between a male and a female, between a brother and a sister, and hopefully kind of understanding how a tragedy can transpire, but then not just living in the worst of worse, but trying to find some healing growth on the other side as much as possible. So I was just so, so excited because I've seen a lot of two-part movies and diptychs that I love. It's a huge one for the inspiration to, for this too, was Chungking Express.
Oh.
And like one of the best films ever. Of course, and it was just like, I got really excited too though within that, like being linked by such a devastating tragedy and then switching characters, like we were all like, is it gonna work? And I kind of believe, because Kelvin is so incredible too, and like I think like Taylor, that girl Emily, has to be amazing or the whole movie collapses and doesn't work. And we just, she's the best, man. Mm-hmm. So owe everything to her too.
It's interesting you brought up dichotomies, because one of the things that you open with is the idea that love is a four-letter word and so is hate.
Yeah.
Which is a killer line. I was just wondering about how you feel about the blurring of those lines. Do you feel like in the film those lines are blurred, or are they diametric opposites?
I think they're blurred. I think for myself, love and hate, like it's about the gray. It's not about the polar opposites. It's about the gray in between, and that's to me what's really human about us and our relationships. You know, human beings are so, so damn complex, and relationships are incredibly complex. Relationships with the people you love the most, where it should be so easy to just communicate, can be incredibly difficult and nuanced. So yes, for me, it's about those dichotomies, but then the gray area between and everything linking together, because that, to me, that's like what life's been like so far.
I've seen this movie twice, and both times the people all around me just broke out into tears.
Wow.
And it's like you walk this delicate line that doesn't quite pass over into melodrama.
Yeah.
And when you're coming up with a story and you're sitting through it for weeks and you're living in it, how do you say, you decide the line between, you know, just like sentimentality and schmaltz?
Yeah, it's a fine line, and I think I will say, however, that I think you could see this movie as a melodrama too, and that's not bad. I think some of the best, I love melodramas, but I do think it's a fine line of, because I myself, it's like everything's coming from a more real place in the sense of like either myself or things from Calvin's perspective or my loved ones, and like drawing on real stuff and real emotion, and then it's just trying to link that to where, I mean, it's a lot in the movie. For some, it might be too much, but it's, you just try to make it as honest as possible and keep it that simple, and stay true to kind of the honesty of that emotion. I think if you try to manipulate it too far and push it too far, that's when it goes to sentimentality and doesn't ring true anymore. I think it's all that stuff.
There's a couple of shots you use in the movie, and you repeat it a couple of times. It's the sort of the 360 spinning while you're inside the car.
Yeah.
And I love those shots, because I really found them just sort of immersive, just sort of getting into the moment with
Thank
the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of curious, like, A, how did you set up that shot? And like, what was kind of the inspiration for it? Because at least from an emotional standpoint, I was like, I'm there with them, and I kind of get what they're all going through. You know?
That's the goal. for setting up, we did... the only other car or shooting in a car that I knew had done that was Children of Men, which has this incredible long take.
Yeah.
But they had to build an entire car rig. We're like an indie movie. We don't have that money. So we just put a slider that's going between the front two seats from the back to the front. We put a remote head on top of that and broke down on Lexa Mini as small as it could go. And so I'm hiding behind the passenger seat with a little monitor and a walkie, and then the dolly grip is hiding behind the driver's seat, and he's doing the sliding motion like this. And then my DP Drew is in the car behind us, and he's has a monitor and he's operating all those spins and the turning. So we're basically figuring out all our camera gadgetry, and then want to make it feel like for them that just forgetting the camera's even there. Literally, it's spinning between them, but we just try to like keep doing it and break it down and make it feel free and loose and organic. I think motivation behind it for me, it's a lot of things. For one is like at that age, you know, I think like first your space is your room, and then it's your car once you get a car, and like your parents can't mess with your car, like your car is freedom, and then being in the car with the person you love, like your girlfriend, like come on, that's ultimate freedom. And then but also it's like between that constant spinning there's a chaos in it, and I hope it also like says something about not only Ty and Alexa's dynamic, because they have so much love for each other, but they're like a bottle of fire, you know. And like, to me, it plays to their dynamic, but it also plays to how Ty's headspace feels there. And it also, just kind of thematically, to me, can feel like love. Like, love is crazy and scary, and I hope, but it's beautiful, and I hope it's a range of emotions with that movement, especially because we primarily do it for that shot, and then we do it again for Tyler, or for Luke and Emily when they're at a similar stage in their relationship, as this kind of visual metaphor for like what love at that time can feel like. But then I feel like when we call it back, there's a melancholy attached, you know, because we've lived through everything else, and Ty and Alexa aren't there anymore, and like, so it kind of, it's beautiful, but it breaks my heart at the same time. So it's all that.
Kelvin, what I was really impressed with, what I was drawn to, is watching you, your interaction, and how different they were between the father and the mother and the sister and the girlfriend. How much of that was instinctive? How much of that was the script? How much of that was your input? Because it truly was, it was a different performance and a different character reaction with every different character.
Yeah. Thanks. I feel like we just talked about, in my life, I interact differently with everybody too. I mean, I'm closer to my sisters, and I'm different with my dad, and I'm different with my mom. And I think it was important to be specific about who brings some comfort, who brings some security, who brings some safety, and who violates those safe spaces. And I think with Alexis is that that's his best friend. And at the end of the day, if he's going to go and tell anyone what's really going on with him, it's her. But at the same time, there is this version of it where he has to have this bravado and he has to provide, because in his version of that, it's like, well, what does a man do based on what I've seen my dad do? What I see how my parents interact? And I think with my dad, it's this fear of disappointing him, and it's fear of disappointing myself. So it's always this like push and pull of trying to live up to the expectation that he has for me, but also trying to live up to the expectation that I have for myself. And therefore, I'm never really in the same space. You know, I'm never on an equal playing field with him. It's always this upper hand with him. And then with my mom, it's just, I think when we look at Ty's relationship, considering that, you know, he lost his biological mother, and having Catherine come to the picture, Renee and I talked about, it was like, she's there for him. They're there for each other. They're the real, this sounds weird, but they're the real couple. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we had this weird dynamic where it was like this unspoken real relationship, because we raised Emily together, you know. And even though, because my dad, how present was he truly, and how available emotionally could he be? So there's all those different relationships were something I had to map out in the script, and something I asked a million questions with Trey about, and we talked for too many hours about it, honestly, to make sure that we knew that this boy wasn't just reactive. He's thoughtful and he's complex and he's a full life of his own, a full thought process. He just doesn't know how to always express it to the best of his ability.
Jumping off of that just for a moment, like one of the most beautiful lines I thought of this film is when the father says, "He's not evil. He's just a human being." So I'm wondering for both of you about that. Like, that's a bold and beautiful statement. Like, what do you think it takes for a character like Tyler to be redeemed, or to, if he's just a human being, like he's in this space, but what is hope for Tyler?
Yeah. What do you think?
What is hope for Tyler?
I think, it's a lot, you know, because basically the worst thing that could happen happens, you know, and it's at his hands, and it's the worst accident mistake of his entire life, and he has to live with that. But for me, hope with that, I personally feel it at the end. He hasn't lost touch with God, and like he's still, you know, he's in prison for a while, but like he can still grow in there. I think, you know, I think that's hope. I think like reckoning or processing reckoning with what's actually happened and trying to grow as a person is kind of all the hope he can do, you know. I don't know. It breaks my damn heart.
What do you think? I feel like there are good situations of this and they're bad, and they don't always come out. A lot of this character too is, for me, what I pulled from was I have two cousins. And their brothers. One of them recently took their life because they had substance use problems, and they couldn't take it anymore. And the other one's left alone. And both of them went to prison at one point or another. Both of them got out at one point or another, but one came out completely different than the other. You don't know what's gonna happen, and you don't know how actions will affect a young person and how it will affect their psyche. All you can do is make sure that we nurture the relationships that we have in front of us. And I know now we're reaching out to my cousin. We're making sure we include him in the family, making sure that he feels loved, make sure he feels safe to be able to express himself, and that we're not going to judge him no matter what happens. So for Tyler, who knows what's going to happen to him? We hope that he finds peace, but we don't know what happens behind those doors.
Sure.
We don't know what he's going to have to get over with. We hope that maybe they can get him some therapy and if that will help, but you can't predict that. So I don't know. I don't know. We just hope for the best.
Yeah. Amen.
I want to throw you guys another kind of cool question.
Yeah.
Because I'm just going to be frank with you. So when I first started hearing about Waves, I saw production stills and saw this black family, and I was like, yo, it's like, this is sick. This drama about the black family, and then I continued reading about it, and I saw your name, and I've already seen some of your movies, and I was like, oh wait,
yeah.
I was like, but it's coming from a white director, and I took a step back for a second. I was like, I'm interested in finding out what this is about.
Yeah.
And when I started watching the movie, I became completely engrossed. Like, I just became engrossed in this family and the fact that this family was every family. It wasn't it wasn't a black family. It wasn't a white. It was just every family, which I thought was incredible. It was really, really beautiful. The thing that really blew my mind though was one scene with Tyler and his father in his bedroom when he was explaining why he's hard on Tyler, right? And he does note to him, it's a racial reason. You're a black man growing up in America, and I need to be hard on you so you are ready for the world that's outside. I want you guys just to talk a little bit about that scene, bringing it to life, conceiving it, just in general, because to me that's like, especially now finding out how the whole script was conceived between the two of you, it makes a lot of sense. And like, I want you to hear like more about that, because like, it's a beautiful scene and it's extremely well handled, and like, kudos to you guys for that. So I want to
thank you so much.
Hear more about that.
Yeah, I think that scene's honestly a perfect example, I think, of our collaboration, because it's in those little therapy sessions, we call them, and in this work and everything, it's about really like finding those commonalities in our experiences, but then the specific differences. So like commonalities, the pressure, the way dad is, I relate to that. For me, it was wrestling. For Kel, it was music. Like, his dad pushed him specifically with music. And then the specificity of a black father and son, like, that's all from Kel, and that's all from talking about that, and that's all from like So I'll listen to him, I'll take a stab, I'll write, he'll get a draft, and then that scene's a very exact scene of like getting specific notes from Kel and like really trying to hear and understand. And then I'll do work and rewrite it and then be like, is this, am I getting closer to truth here? Is this more authentic to your experience? And it's all in that collaboration and communication and just trying to understand, you know? And
yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. I mean, I think what was the thing, the conversation to make him, Ronald, to be the black man that he is, was trying to understand my own dad and the stories he would tell me. I mean, I feel like a lot of friends I know and a lot of young black men have had that conversation with their dad. And so it was just, you know, Trey had a similar conversation. That's what was so mind-boggling to me.
Yeah.
It's like, he had a similar conversation about being the best,
yeah,
and being number one. But I was like, what happens when you add the pressure and the history of black people onto that and tackle and put that chip on Ronald's shoulder? And, you know, I remember my dad, you know, he told me, because we were looking at a family that's privileged at the end of the day. This is a, you know, a middle-class family. These kids, you could dye his hair blonde, you could drive a monster truck. That's not happening everywhere.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, my dad was like, he came to my room, he was like, you're spoiled. You do know that, right? Let me remind you what you look like. Let me remind you who you are, and let me remind you where you came from. And it was just like this moment for me, it was just like, I didn't ask for this. You know what I mean? I didn't ask for all of this information, but it was a necessary piece that I needed to understand in order to keep going in my life. So with that scene, it was explaining, you know, where did Ronald come from? And that's when we started talking about, you know, my grandparents. And I told Trey stories about my three papa. He owned a cab company. He was like one of the first black men to own a cab company in New Orleans, but he never drove my dad around. He literally was like, my dad was like, I would walk from Toulouse Street to like St. Charles to the West Bank with my saxophone at 12 years old, and my dad owned a cab company. He wouldn't even bring me anywhere. He was like, you don't understand how good you have it. You don't understand that the person next to you, my dad also played with Harry Connick Jr., who's a big star today. He was in his band at 14. Where's my dad? He's teaching at a middle school and he hates his job right now. But, you know, it's just the idea that I could be just as talented as the person next to me, but will I have the same opportunities? Do you understand that? And so it was putting all that on, you know, explaining that to Trey, and then Trey heard it all, and he wrote a monologue, and I was just like, well, that checks out.
No, it really does, because it's fucking honest, man. It's real. It's real. It's real. Good job, guys. Good job.
Jumping back to the camera work, I thought the camera work is so extraordinary in this movie, and how essentially the entire film is just, like, injected with this visual artistry. So, Kelvin, did you find you had to edit your acting process because of how intimate the camera gets? And Trey, were there any particular scenes that maybe you thought would be easier to shoot and then you arrived on set and you're like, oh, shit.
I think every act is different on this movie. I think because I've worked with Trey before and I understood what it would look like. I mean, the first time when I was when it comes to night, I was like, I don't know what's happening. Like, where's the camera? What is it shooting? How did you get that? And when did you shoot that? I remember watching the movie that first time. I was like, when was that? But this time I came in way more prepared and ready to go. And also, like, he put the aspect ratios changing and what the movie would kind of look like in the script. So going into it, I would always be like, well, you know, where is he today? Where's that guy? He's over there? So then you can kind of, like, you know, you don't necessarily change the performance, but you know whether or not, am I doing too much? Am I doing too little? And Trey will tell me, so you have an awareness of it, but at the same time, we still have the freedom to play constantly, and it never felt like I was constricted by a camera. I was always just able to just be honest, and I think that was one of the easiest thing about doing that performance was not feeling like, once again, I don't want to overact or overdo anything. If anything, I get accused of underacting. And I think that's because I was like, I'm just going to be a human being, and I know he'll capture it. I trusted him in that way. So, yeah.
That was a big thing, you know, because what Drew and I talk about, too, like, I think a movie like this lives and dies by its performances. So if we're ever taking camera and stuff too far to where we're getting in the way and impeding their performance, then we failed. So it's always, for us, it's like, yeah, it's just trying to, like, we prepare, plan this, all this stuff, but then be ready to adapt, change, and, like, really just, like, whatever they need to. Honestly, the hardest thing, I think the most difficult, just for practical reasons, thing to shoot was the scene when Ty, there's a single take when he arrives at the party on that night, and he leaves his truck and goes through the whole party and goes upstairs, and It was a long take. It was a very complex lighting setup. It was a million extras, and I'd never worked. I mean, like, my first movie had like 10 people. My second movie had like 8 people. And this is like
one location.
I definitely got there. I was like, okay, this is a lot harder than because we've done long takes and stuff, and blocking just at that magnitude with that many moving parts was hard, but amazing. You know, once we got there, it was amazing. And I just get, I mean, to me, I have the best team. It's like not only the best actors, like the best crew, and yeah, you figure it out together.
This is such a flashy movie. It's bold and colorful, and there's bold camera movements, but there's also these subtle choices too, like Emily doesn't let her hair out till she comes out of her shell at the end of the movie.
Mm.
Could you guys talk about maybe some of the subtle choices in production design and costumes that helped you define the characters?
Yeah. Again, that's like you said, like that's the dichotomy again, right? It's like, hopefully at times the style's, you know, going crazy because that feels true to what the character's going through. Then at other times it has to be incredibly nuanced and I'm trying to think broad strokes with the costume and styles. I love that you noticed that.
That's Taylor's idea. I remember she was saying, she was like, I feel like Calvin,
yep.
Trey.
Absolutely.
And she should straighten her hair. And when she finally comes out, she's curly and free.
It was very collaborative with Tay of like the arc of her hair, you know, and especially for a woman, it's like, it's very important. So for me, it was just listening to her, understanding that, embedding that. It was the same process with Cal for like, for the blonde, you know? It was, we were in Target and trying to figure out
how to do something different. And we talked about like Odell Beckham and, you know, Frank, and we talked about Chris Brown and all these younger guys. Even we see kids on the street now with blonde hair, and it's just like, what are we trying to say with that? You know, it's this expression and this idea of trying to be kind of rebel, get a little bit against the family and the mold that you kind of need to stand out. Is that, yeah, so stuff like that. And
And just work it, just use
the same colors.
Even the cross on your neck and
everything. The cross on the neck is,
It's all just talking through. For me, it's all with the actors, like talking through. So for Kelly, it was all that and that stuff, and just discussing thing and embedding and kind of building this character together. And then for Tay, for the opposite end. The arc with her hair or anything, I'm a white man, like, I value your perspective here for everything and trust you to anything. So like, it's just collaboration and listening and understanding and trying to embed that and hopefully build a very honest character and world together, you know.
Awesome.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much. First time doing this kind of thing.
I know, this is cool.
Thank you, guys.